apologize for the delay. We had an incident earlier in Dover this morning that delayed everyone in getting here, but we appreciate your patience. Are you ready to proceed?
Make introductions before we begin. Lisa Schmidt from Richards Leighton Finger. I have with me Barry Chasnov from Akin Gump. He is prepared to make the argument on behalf of all defendants, but some other defendants' counsel may respond to specific questions.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Your Honor, it's Richard Hines of Ashby & Geddes for Appellee AIG Life Insurance Company, and I'd just like to introduce my co-counsel, James Jordan, from Jordan Burton.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Morning, Your Honors. Julie Saunders from Skadden, and I have from Marsh, and I have Marco Schnabel from our New York office with me.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the court.
May I please support Elizabeth Wilburn of Blank Rome on behalf of Defendant Appellee National Benefits Group, Inc., and I have with me my co-counsel, Ian Kaminsky of Blank Rome, Philadelphia.
And welcome to the court.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
Gregory Inskip from Potter Anderson, and I would like to introduce to the court Michelle Horton, a partner of Morgan Lewis & Bacchius, who will present the appellant's argument this afternoon.
And good afternoon. Welcome. And before you begin, let me tell you about our clock. I'm going to turn it on, and it's going to start with your full 20 minutes counting down. And when you get to the orange light, that will indicate the amount of time you wanted to reserve for rebuttal. You could continue speaking, but you'll be using up your rebuttal time.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and my colleagues, thank you for permitting me to appear here today. I appreciate the privilege. My name is Michelle Horton. I'm with Morgan Lewis & Bacchius. We represent Walmart Stores, Inc., Walmart Stores Grantor Trust, and for purposes of this motion, we'll refer to both as Walmart. We're here on a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6. Standards are very well settled, but I think they bear repeating. That is that all well-pleaded allegations will be taken as true, that facts will be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which is Walmart. To the extent that there are inferences, and reasonable inferences that can be drawn from those facts, those reasonable inferences must be drawn in favor of Walmart. And then applying those standards, if this court determines that under any conceivable set of facts or circumstances, Walmart's claim would be supportable, a remand or a proceeding on the merits would be appropriate, and that's what we ask the court to do. This case arises from COLI programs. COLI stands for Corporate-Owned Life Insurance. It's a financial arrangement which is largely tax-driven, but does have insurance components to it. The quintessential characteristics of a COLI program are that the employer, in this case Walmart, purchases life insurance on certain of its employees, pays the premiums, names the corporation as the beneficiary, and obtains the benefits of life insurance if the employee dies. The types of COLI programs that we are involved in here are called broad-based leverage COLI programs. They are not your typical insurance. They are certainly not your grandfather's insurance. It is a very complex arrangement between the Internal Revenue Code, actuarial principles that are standard in the insurance industry, and accounting principles that are standard in the insurance industry. And by blending the tax code with the insurance code provisions in the tax laws and in the accounting laws, corporations like Walmart were able to obtain positive cash flow benefits from the use of COLI programs, but only if they were able to have the tax deductions that were essential to the program's financial vitality. And in this case, those tax deductions were ultimately disallowed. Plans failed. Walmart lost $130 million based on its experts' reports, not including the lost tax deductions. And our best estimate of what the defendants gained on these failed programs was over $100 million. So we have Walmart with a loss of $130 million. We have the defendants with a gain of $100 million on failed products that the defendants created, marketed, tailored to Walmart, sold to Walmart, and administered throughout the entire time the programs were created. These were not policies or financial arrangements that were developed by Walmart. these were products that were developed by the insurance industry, and that's not disputed. Walmart began purchasing its policies in December of 1993, continued purchasing policies until July of 1995, at which time it became apparent that Congress was going to prospectively, and prospectively is an important term, eliminate benefits on COLI programs. So Walmart, in light of the pending legislation in July of 1995, made its last COLI purchase. In August of 1996, Congress did, in fact, the HIPAA legislation, which included as a component the disallowance of tax benefits under the under COLI programs on a prospective basis. COLI programs in place were not affected by the legislation, only COLI programs going forward. At the outset of these programs, the parties had contemplated the possibility of a legislative change to the COLI programs that would prospectively affect financial benefits. And beginning in 1996, Walmart's plans went into a wind-down mode, and the wind-down provisions had been negotiated early on when the programs were, when the policies were first purchased. And from August of 96 to January of 2000, the policies were in a wind-down mode whereby the financial benefits that would have been taken on future policies weren't being provided, but the tax deductions that had been taken on the prior policies were in place. January 2000, Walmart surrenders its policies, gives them back, money's returned, relationships are terminated between the brokers, consultants, and the life insurance companies that issued these policies. From January 2000 to August of 2002, Walmart negotiated with the IRS over the disallowance of tax benefits under these policies. It negotiated the best deal it could, sought to mitigate its damages, and it ultimately arrived at a settlement with the IRS where approximately 80% of the tax benefits were disallowed, 20% of the benefits were retained. About a month later, Walmart brought this lawsuit, September 3, 2002.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yes,
because I think there's something that you didn't mention in the chronology that, if I'm not misunderstanding this matter, is of some importance, or arguably of some importance. You explained that in 1995, Walmart knew that there was pending legislation and that the whole COLI deal was going to vanish, right? But prospectively at that
time. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So Walmart responded by going into its wind-down phase, which had been one of the things that was a possibility that was anticipated and you were dealing with it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, if I'm not mistaken, though, in 1997, didn't the first set of bad news come in with respect to what was going to happen retroactively, not affecting Walmart directly, but that the IRS had disallowed or indicated that it was going to impose penalties and disallow deductions for other companies that had virtually the same program that you had?
In 1997, it is our understanding that the IRS began challenging the deductions for other COLI employers, and that they issued revenue rulings or tax advisory memoranda to other corporate employers that were saying, we don't think that your COLI programs are going to meet the economic substance test of the Internal Revenue Code.
Okay, my concern is this. Your claim against these defendants is that they misled you. They sold you something that they claimed would serve one purpose, and they didn't advise you of the risks and that sort of thing, right?
There are several claims, Your Honor.
Okay.
One is that they didn't advise us of criticisms and challenges to the COLI plans that they were aware of prior to selling us the plans and during the course of selling us the plans. They never advised us of certain challenges by state insurance regulators, challenges by law firms, challenges by accountants who had looked at these programs and had said they are much more tenuous than the representations that were being made to us. Secondarily, they also said that if these programs do fail, we are going to minimize or mitigate your losses, and we will share the burden of those losses with you. That is the way these programs were designed to operate. In 1997, there had been no court decision, no legislation that had said these COLI plans were lacked economic substance. It wasn't until October 19, 1999, that the first tax court decision came out that ruled that these policies, these broad-based leverage COLI policies, did not meet the economic substance test. And that was the Winn-Dixie case. And that's within the three-year window of our lawsuit. But even Winn-Dixie was a hotly contested case. It was a full-blown trial at the tax court, expert, lots of evidence, it went on for weeks, perhaps months.
Okay, let's go back to the 1997. Didn't Walmart at that point have reason to be concerned that maybe what they had been told by the defendants was not accurate, given the position that the IRS was taking?
Concern, perhaps, Your Honor, but at that time, in 1997, policies were performing as contemplated. The tax benefits had been taken, the deductions had been taken. The wind-down procedures were in effect, and the parties were performing under the contract as contemplated. And there had been no loss, no injury to Walmart or to any other COLI policyholder at that time. And there, in our opening brief, at pages 23 to 25, and in particular the Walker case and the West Los Angeles Cancer Treatment versus Mayer case, and a host of other cases, all say that if the IRS is challenging a liability, your claims arising from a disallowance of a tax benefit do not accrue until that liability is established. And it makes perfect sense, Your Honor, because until the liability is established, there is a possibility that there will never be any claims, that the policies will in fact perform the way that they were intended to perform, provide Walmart with all the benefits that it anticipated, all the benefits that it was promised, and there would never, ever be any claims, and we wouldn't be here today. And one case doesn't necessarily make the law. Winn-Dixie came out in October of 1999, and it laid out some of the problems with the COLI plans. A year later, the CM Holdings case came down in a bankruptcy court. CM Holdings identified the flaws in the programs that, in much more detail than Winn-Dixie, CM Holdings found that it was the insurance industry's treatment, accounting treatment, actuarial treatment, surplus, dividends, interest rates that resulted in the determination that the policies themselves lacked economic substance and the deductions would be disallowed. It wasn't what Walmart did with the policies. It wasn't the way Walmart accounted for the policy proceeds or benefits. It was the way the policies were structured by the defendants and the characteristics, the accounting characteristics, the insurance characteristics, and the tax characteristics peculiar to the insurance industry were laid out as the basis for the court's determination that the policies lacked economic substance. A year later, another case comes out. 2001, it's the American Electric Power case. It too goes through in great detail the flaws in the policies, again focusing on the way the insurance industry had characterized the financial transaction, not in the way the policyholder had. It ultimately disallowed the deductions. But it was those three cases, one after another, 1999, 2000, 2001, all of them going directly up on appeal, that provided, in my view and in Walmart's view, the first notice that there was going to be a real problem with these policies. And Walmart did what any prudent corporate employer would do at the time and what many other corporate employers did. They tried to defend the validity of these programs, just like the defendants here did. They testified in these tax trials. They testified that these policies would provide economic substance, that they met all of the requirements of the code, that the actuarial principles were appropriate. So you have Walmart and the defendants and many other corporate employers and many other insurance companies all defending the bona fides of these programs. And you have the courts coming down one, two, three, saying, no, you're wrong. And it was only at that point that Walmart settled with the fairness because the writing was on the wall. It could have, all it would have done is increase its damages. It would have had more penalties, more legal fees, and its policies were going to be declared economic shams. And that's and that was the basis of the settlement. But up until that point, everybody had every incentive to defend the validity of these programs, and for us to bring a lawsuit while we are negotiating with the IRS, and while other corporate employers are litigating with the IRS over the bona fides of this, would be like putting a gun to our head. It would be precipitating the very loss that we would ultimately claim from others. And I don't think that the law or equity would require Walmart, as a prudent corporate entity, to bring lawsuits at a time before it had suffered losses, when those losses were purely speculative, because whether or not those losses were going to accrue was something that was going to happen in the future, and to initiate complex litigation over a hypothetical situation. And I think under Delaware's rules, I don't think Walmart would have had a right claim.
Let me interrupt you at this point. What exactly, what precisely is it, in your client's view, that triggered the operation of the statute of limitations? Was it the establishment of liability, or was it the incurrence of a loss?
The incurrence of a loss.
And what was the loss in this case?
The loss in this case was the failure of the COLI programs to provide the tax benefits that have been, that underpin the entire financial vitality of those policies.
And when did that occur?
August of 2002.
And that was coincident with what?
That was coincident with a resolution with the IRS.
That really was still a voluntary settlement. That is, if it was a loss, it was a loss that your client voluntarily created, established.
And the defendants have challenged that, and I think if that does, I don't think their challenge to our settlement with the IRS should affect the statute of limitations or lapses arguments. It may be a defense to their damages. If they come in and they prove that we settled unreasonably.
Well, but the reason I ask is that in most cases, it's an outside objective event that triggers the running of the statute of limitations. In this case, under your theory, it's your client's own act that causes the statute to run.
Well, Your Honor, it's our client didn't act voluntarily. It didn't. It acted only after there had been three decisions on these COLI policies that had disallowed the benefits that it was claiming. It acted under severe legal compulsion.
Oh, perhaps, from the IRS. it still made a decision, uncoerced, I assume, to settle at a particular point in time, and it's at that point in time that you contend the statute began to run. Correct?
Yes.
And if that decision had been made earlier, then the statute would have run earlier.
Yes.
And likewise, if your client decided to play the deck out and litigate only when there was a final judgment, I suppose, would the statute begin to run? Is that
that's
your
correct
client's view of the limitations rule?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what we believe the limitations rule ought to be. And there is the Mayer case, the Walker case, and the cases that we have cited all hold for that proposition, that while you are negotiating with the IRS, the validity of a tax benefit or a tax allowance, the statute of limitations on that claim does not accrue, because if you prevail, which Dow Chemical did in their case.
So your real argument is an establishment of liability argument, not necessarily a loss argument.
Your Honor, I don't think establishment of liability is the issue. I think it's the loss. We have the concerns regarding the programs arose, as Your Honor said, beginning in 1997, but those concerns weren't codified, they weren't embodied in any judicial decision. It was a bona fide dispute between the IRS and
I understand that.
And the taxpayers.
But the loss in this case equates to paying out money. And the timing of that was within your client's control.
We're not trying to seek the lost tax deductions. We're seeking out the out-of-pocket expenses associated with the program, and they're significant. We're not saying that these defendants have to give us back what we would have been able to deduct from our tax code. What we are asking for them to give us back under the restitution claim is their profits. And under the tort and contract claims is our losses, out-of-pocket losses. We're not holding them responsible for the...
When were those out-of-pocket losses incurred? At one point in time or over a period of time?
Over a period of time. And over the entire time that the contract was being performed. And it was being performed by both sides.
All right, then we're not talking about losses or the incurrence of losses being the trigger, because if that were the case, the losses started way back before 2002. It has to be the time in which your client ascertained with some objective, that it had a right to recover those losses. Is that right?
That's correct.
And that was when?
And that was in the loss. The money we paid wasn't a loss until August of 2002, because had we prevailed with the IRS, then there would be no losses. The policies would have functioned as contemplated, as they were performed, and there would have been positive benefits flowing from the contracts, but they did not. So it wasn't until our liability was established, and it was established by way of a settlement, but only after three court cases.
I've stopped the clock so that you have a minute for rebuttal. Otherwise, we would have used up all of your time.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I am Barry Chasnoff here on behalf of Appley Hartford. During the time period counsel was talking about, Walmart bought hundreds of thousands of policies on the lives of its employees. Contemporaneously, he did not mention, with the initial purchase of those policies, Walmart executed a letter of understanding. And what that letter of understanding said was that they had reviewed with their own tax advisors and with their own insurance advisors and with their own lawyers all aspects of the ownership of those policies.
Is this part of the record on the motion to dismiss under 12b-6?
It is, Your Honor. In their pleading, they specifically reference the letter of understanding. One of their complaints, I believe it's in paragraph 80E, is that we did not disclose the contents of this letter of understanding to the Department of Insurance, and it was part of the policy. They are suing on the policy. It's clearly an essential part of their claim and referenced in the complaint. Vice Chancellor Lamb found that it was appropriate under the case cited in his opinion in our brief to rely on the letter of understanding on a motion to dismiss.
Your Honor, James Jordan for AIG, to which the letter of understanding was issued, that document in the contract itself says it is attached to and made a part of the policy.
Now, and then to finish that thought, attached to the letter of understanding and also incorporated into the policy by reference is a statement that Walmart had made its own determination that it had an insurable interest in the lives of the employees on whose lives it was seeking insurance. In spite of that, they filed this lawsuit almost a decade after that letter of understanding is signed, complaining that although there were risks, there were certain unspecified risks relating to the tax implications and insurable interest that hadn't been disclosed.
Excuse me, just to get right down to the point of it here, what's the date on which you claim the statute of limitations started to run?
It accrued the day they purchased the policies, because the complaint is that risk was not disclosed at the time of the purchase, and these undisclosed risks should have been disclosed to them, they say, before they made the purchase. Now, they say there was no injury at that time. Interesting. They say in their complaint they paid $1.3 billion in initial premium, and that to make this tax plan work, they took out large loans at high interest rates, which they were paying. The easy way from our perspective to get to the accrual argument is to say, well, suppose that on the day after they purchased those policies, all of us had written them a letter that said, you know what, we forgot to disclose the extent of the risk. There's something we didn't tell you. It's riskier than we told you. We told you it was risky. You signed a letter of understanding, but it's even riskier. Surely on the day they received that letter, they could have sued and said, wait, we want our $1.3 billion back, and we don't want to have to keep paying this interest. So arguments about what they knew are not really an accrual argument. It's a tolling argument because they had a lawsuit. They're just saying, well, we didn't really know enough.
That may be true under a tort theory, but there are contract and restitution theories as well, and those theories may be governed by different limitations concepts. Is that right?
Well, it may be, but not in any court of which we are aware. Their theory is, well, first of all, as we've said in our brief and as Vice Chancellor Lamb found, they didn't plead it. They didn't plead a non-wrong claim. This whole claim comes from, for extending it, is, well, we've made a rescission theory. Rescission doesn't require a wrong. Therefore, it accrues the time of the injury. Well, that's not in their complaint, and Vice Chancellor Lamb looked at it and found it wasn't in their complaint. They plead a constructive trust, which has as an element a wrong. But beyond that, they really cite three cases for this proposition that you don't have to have a wrong, you have to injure. One of them is the Fleer case by this court. Very unusual situation.
Well, before you get into that, counsel, was there not an independent, separate claim for breach of contract?
There was a breach of contract claim.
All right, and presumably the statute of limitations on that claim would run from the time of the breach.
The alleged breach was a failure to disclose. It's really an improper, a fraudulent inducement to enter the contract. There is no allegation in the complaint that we didn't pay a benefit when we were supposed to, or that we in any other way breached the contract itself.
So it may be denominated a contract claim, but it really isn't. It's a tort claim of some kind.
In essence.
And the restitution claim, is that or is that not separately pled?
Well, they do ask for restitution, but based upon a constructive trust theory, and constructive trust requires a wrong.
But restitution, putting aside the remedy you're talking about, requires an unjust enrichment. Would the statute not run from the time the enrichment became unjust?
Well, sticking with their complaint, what they say makes the enrichment unjust was the failure to disclose. And the failure to disclose took place before the policy was purchased.
So if there was a failure to disclose, then no matter how the cause of action is characterized, as your side reads the complaint, the statute, under any theory, would be triggered from the moment the arrangement was entered into.
Right. And Vice Chancellor Lamb, when this argument was going on, and we cite in our brief, asked the same sort of question. What is it that you're complaining about? And counsel concedes that the complaint is that they didn't tell us before we bought the policy about the extent of the risk. That's what they're saying we did wrong. And when we did it wrong was before they bought it.
But as I understand your earlier comments, this letter they signed that was incorporated by reference, it ended their case before it ever began, because they basically acknowledged that they were buying something and that was risky, and your characterization would be, in the tort language, they assumed the risk. So they went into it with their eyes open.
They certainly, I guess it would be a factual argument that they had their eyes open. The legal argument is they should have, from the objective, they signed something that said, we have our eyes open, we are aware this is risky from a tax perspective, we are aware that there's an insurable interest question, we have consulted with our own advisors, and frankly, a plan where the biggest company in the country, maybe it's in the world, I don't know, is going to put $1.3 billion of initial premium in and has its own tax advisors and insurance advisors, they certainly are aware of the risk.
So your position is, after the first policy was issued, nothing that happened subsequent to that gave rise to any cause of action?
It may have, but not any cause of action they pled.
Well, we don't want to tell them about any ones they don't know about.
I do, however, have a family to support you. But no, what they say we did wrong, and is we didn't tell them before they bought it, and we should have said it's really, I guess, riskier than even you know.
Well, it seems there's a disconnect in your theories of the case, because what Mr. Horton is saying is until they settled with the IRS, they didn't know these deductions would be allowed, and you were involved in these other three lawsuits. Everybody was taking the disallowed. Everyone was taking the position that these deductions would be allowed by the IRS, and therefore the triggering event was settling with the IRS. As I understand your argument, the triggering event, if there was one, was when the policies were issued with these risks.
Yes, and the legal analysis of whether there's some excuse for them not filing that lawsuit under the decisions in Delaware is not an accrual analysis, it is a tolling analysis. Was there some reason to toll the statute of limitations?
Well, and so if you would, you might have said this, but respond directly to his argument that if he had filed suit earlier, you would have raised as a defense, the deductions have not been disallowed. Therefore, you can't bring a suit because it could be that we're right and the deductions will be allowed.
Yes, they denominate this in their reply brief their murder-suicide theory. That is, we're going to be pleading that they're invalid on one hand and on the other hand they're valid. They cite not a single case to support this, and although there's no Delaware case that uses the term murder-suicide, we have, there are Delaware cases, which we can provide afterwards or cite them now. It came up in the reply brief, which, and cases from other states, Delaware, Vermont, Colorado, North Dakota. And what they say is if the appropriate way in this situation is to file a lawsuit within the statute of limitations, plead in the alternative, and seek to abate or stay the case. And so in this case, what they would have said is, in the case against us, is we believe the deductions are valid, but if they turn out not to be valid, we took them because of these bad guys over here, and we reserve our right to go after them. The advantage of that is that it preserves their case, and there's a reason for the statute of limitations. We have a right to be on notice within a certain period of time. We know to preserve evidence. We need to know to preserve documents. We know we're at risk. We would have been on notice. Their position would have been preserved, and then they could have preserved their, pursued their lawsuit. We found no case to the contrary. And courts do this uniformly around the country.
So in your view, in the fact that the deductions were disallowed, was simply a foreseeable event when they entered into the policy.
Well, they haven't sued us for the disallowed deductions. They sued us for the risk they would be disallowed.
Right. And so, stating it using your terms, the risk that they would be disallowed to the extent that happened in 2002 is just something that they were put on notice of from day one.
From day one, they knew there was a risk that this would be disallowed. And frankly, if they didn't know it then, they certainly should have known it when there were articles in the Wall Street Journal talking about Walmart and these big deductions back in 96, 97, and those are all in the record. And just a side note, they say in the reply brief those articles only talk about in the future they may be disallowed. If you read the articles actually talk about how it may be retroactive as well. And then these tax advisory memoranda. These TAMs, clearly the IRS was going after them. And he mentions the decisions in these three huge tax decisions, tax cases. Those things were not decided the day after they were filed. They were decided in 99, 2000, but those cases had gone on for years and on exactly these issues. So everybody was who had any interest in this topic at all was well aware that the IRS was challenging these deductions retroactively. I want to respond briefly to his cites to the Walker and Mayer case. First of all, counsel said twice that Walker and Mayer and the host of other cases we cited with, they cite Walker and Mayer, two cases, for this proposition that in a tax case, you don't have to make a decision until after the IRS issue is resolved. Walker and Mayer are two Ninth Circuit decisions over 30 years ago, where the Ninth Circuit was predicting what they thought the states of Oregon and Arizona were likely to do. And by the way, those states have never done this. But more critically, neither of those cases involved a taxpayer that assumed the foreseeable risk of the loss of tax deductions, as Walmart did here. Mayer, the Ninth Circuit, upholds the trial court finding, the district court finding, that the parties shifted the risk in the contract. If the IRS disallows it, then you have to pay. So the triggering event was the IRS disallowed it. In Walker, the issue had been waived, the Ninth Circuit said. Nonetheless, in both cases, they go on and talk about the statute of limitations accrues later. It's dicta, and the reality is it's bad dicta. It's just not right. Because the decision reflected in court after court across the country is that a party may not rescind the contract based upon frustration of commercial purpose where the risk was foreseeable, and the party seeking to rescind it did not shift the risk in the contract.
I'm having a bit of a problem with your analysis because it seems to blend together basically merits defenses with limitations concepts.
I understand what you're saying, and what's happened here is they've tried to throw in this triggering event of what triggers a rescission, the statute of limitations on rescission, and they've made up a claim that does a cause of action that doesn't exist and says, well, that's what will trigger limitations.
If they don't have a cause of action, I understand that, but that's not before us.
Right.
But assuming that they do, then the question is, when does the limitations period begin to run? And that's why I'm having trouble with, okay, you know, but what would otherwise be wonderful defense arguments on the merits.
The limitations period, getting back to what they pled and what happened in those cases, what they plead is, you didn't tell us about the risk, and therefore it should be rescinded. When we didn't tell them about the risk was before the contract was signed. And that's when their cause of action accrued. That was the wrong, and frankly, that's when the injury began. I mean, what they want to say is we want to hedge our bets and play this out as long as we can and then decide when we've accumulated all of our injury. I mean, we've gotten into talking about as if no injury, they do, as if no injury occurred until they paid the taxes, but as counsel said, they're not suing us to get back the taxes they paid in 2002. They're suing us to get back, for the most part, what they paid when they signed the contract. When they gave us $1.3 billion and when they started paying us interest. So all of that, whether it's under rescission theory or any other theory, the wrong occurred and the injury occurred way back there.
Your argument then, and I'm just repeating your own words, is that we're not really talking about accrual, we're talking about tolling.
Yes.
Well, why wasn't there a tolling here, or at least a fact issue, that would have precluded a 12B6 dismissal?
Inherently unknowable is an element of tolling for any of the three theories that they pled of tolling. And first of all, let's start with, it wasn't unknowable there was a risk there. It was known. They signed a letter indicating they knew about the risk. So look at whether it was inherently unknowable. When you look at the cases on inherently unknowable, never have they been applied to sophisticated parties in arm's length transactions. Inherently unknowable is something that you couldn't figure out, that a sophisticated, it's never been used for a sophisticated company. Not only was it known at the time they signed the contract, there were newspaper articles, there were the tax advisory memorandum. Even if it was unknowable when they signed a letter saying they knew about it, it was certainly knowable when there were articles in the newspaper about Walmart and these tax deductions and the threats by the IRS. And when the tax advisory memorandum came out, when the IRS started suing everybody over these issues. Now, there are other tolling theories. They don't even plead many of the elements. What they've done is filed a lawsuit. They've amended that lawsuit. And what they complain about is that we did not warn them at the time of the risk. What they're claiming now is not that it was these risks were undisclosed, but they seem to be saying, well, the problem is we didn't know how the risks were going to turn out. That isn't what they've pled. Under long-established law of the and judicial precedent of the state of Delaware, and for policy reasons shared universally across this country, including about shifting risk in commercial contracts by the courts, their cause of action accrued when they signed the contract, when they paid for it. No tolling doctrine applies. Their claims are barred. Vice Chancellor Lamb's ruling should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Chancellor.
Thank you.
I apologize for running over. I'll hit staccato the points that I'd like to. If you have questions, please ask. The sum and substance of this motion is really there are questions of fact that are to permeate every aspect of this. Whether there was an injury is a question of fact. Perhaps there was an injury in some metaphysical sense when the policies were purchased, but not in a practical sense. Second, on a restitution claim, you can't have a restitution claim until there's been an unjust enrichment. The unjust enrichment did not occur until the IRS issues were completely resolved. It would have been premature to bring any claims before then. Assuming there had been an injury at the outset in a metaphysical sense, for want of a better term, there's tolling. There's the facts that gave rise to the demise of these policies were peculiarly within their knowledge. There was a continuous relationship between the parties. There were fiduciary relationships established between these parties, and there was a mutual running account, all of which would have ended in January 2000, within the 3 years. Thank you so much.
And thank you. And thank you both very much. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the United States.